We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Building the Machine, the new podcast series from Red Leg Nation Radio. Over these 12 episodes, we're bringing you the story of the Big Red Machine, Cincinnati's baseball dynasty that changed the game forever. Day by day, year by year, you're seeing how the machine was constructed, all the highs and lows, and the legacy that remains. Each week, we've been bringing you a new episode focusing on a single year from 1969 to 1979. If you didn't get to experience the Big Red Machine as they were dominating baseball, you're going to enjoy the chance to experience the story as if you were there and learn more about the names and events that were so important in shaping the narrative around the Cincinnati Reds. We're also talking about how things were different in that era, from salary negotiations to the way the game was played on the field to the things that happened that made this team become what it became. If you were fortunate enough to watch the machine live, this has been a fun blast from the past. This is episode 9. So long, big dog. Joining me again to talk about the 1977 Cincinnati Reds is Bill Lack. How are you today, Bill?
I'm wonderful. I'm ready to talk about the year of 1977.
1977 will begin, as we always do, with a look at what was going on in the world in 1977 to give a little bit of context to the discussion. In the news, that was the year that Jimmy Carter was sworn in as the 39th President of the United States. One day later, he pardons Vietnam War draft evaders. Silver Jubilee celebrations are held in the United Kingdom to celebrate 25 years of Elizabeth II's reign. I'm sure you were really, back in 77, really celebrating the Silver Jubilee, weren't you, Bill?
As much as I was the 50th.
The first Apple II series computers go on sale that year, and Atari released its video computer system in North America. And, of course, Atari became the biggest gaming system in the world, and we know what Apple did. So a couple of big electronics releases that year, Bill. I know you're a big Apple guy.
I am a big Apple guy. I never had an Apple II, but I had my first computer was an Apple SE that I had on my desk that had a screen that was, what, about 4 inches across, 6 inches across?
Good times. Did you have an Atari gaming system?
No, I've never been a video game guy, ever.
Oh, man, I'll never forget the Christmas where we got the Atari system and Missile Command and Pac-Man. Oh my goodness, just amazing.
It was amazing, huh?
Yeah, it was incredible. 1977, David Berkowitz was captured in Yonkers, New York, after over a year of murders in New York City as the son of Sam. Now, Bill, tell us about what happened in the Cincinnati area that year.
Well, and this was over Memorial Day weekend in 1977, the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire over across the river in northern Kentucky. Killed 165 people, and I knew people that were there that night. In fact, somebody I knew from high school perished in that fire. I had a number of people that I know that were there the night before. I happened to be home on leave. This is a very big memory for me.
Yeah, horrific, horrific. Let's move on to movies and a more lighthearted affair. George Lucas's Star Wars opened in cinemas and became the highest grossing film of its time. Bill, I'm sure you were there on day one to see Star Wars.
No, but I did see it in the theater. I I honestly don't remember seeing Star Wars in the theater. I saw the next two in the theater later on, but I don't remember seeing Star Wars.
I will never forget going to The Phantom Menace with Bill as he had on his Obi-Wan Kenobi costume.
Phantom Menace? No, never saw it.
Smokey and the Bandit also came out that year, and another underrated star-related film, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Steven Spielberg, Smokey and the Bandit, and Close Encounters were the second and third on the box office list.
I never really got Close Encounters. I've seen it a number of times, but it really does nothing for me.
What about Smokey and the Bandit?
I loved Smokey and the Bandit. I rewatched it again recently. Gleason is freaking hysterical.
Yeah, if you don't love Smokey and the Bandit, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, there's definitely something wrong with you, but I think Gleason is what makes that movie.
Number four on the box office list, Saturday Night Fever, which launched John Travolta into the stratosphere. We'll talk more about that maybe later. Roger Moore's best Bond film came out that year. Do you agree with that? That's my opinion. The Spy Who Loved Me.
No, I don't. Which his co-star later on was Ringo Starr's wife. Ringo Starr later married Barbara Bach. No, I think Roger Moore's best Bond film was made a couple years later, For Your Eyes Only.
What's Roger Moore's worst?
His worst is the all-time worst James Bond, A View to a Kill.
Wrong. You're wrong again, Bill. It's Moonraker.
No, I'm never wrong about Bond.
It's Moonraker.
Moonraker would probably be my second worst.
Okay.
But View to a Kill is the worst.
Well, we're in the same neighborhood.
yeah, absolutely.
Perhaps my favorite film of all time came out that year. Annie Hall, it would go on to win Best Picture, and Woody Allen would win Best Director. What else came out that year, Bill?
Annie Hall's a wonderful film. It really is. Other movies that I enjoyed that year, The Goodbye Girl, where Richard Dreyfuss won the Academy Award. Oh God, with George Burns, and a wonderfully funny movie, Slapshot, with Paul Newman.
Classic hockey movie.
Yes.
Talk to us about the world in music in 1977, Bill.
Well, Led Zeppelin set a new world record for attendance in an indoor concert in the Silver Dome, where they played before 76,229 people on their 77 North American tour. You mentioned Saturday Night Fever earlier. The soundtrack was released, and it featured five new Bee Gees compositions, and it'd go on to become the best-selling movie or album of all time. And I recently saw something about the movie and one of these, you know, Trivium TV shows telling them about it. And if you remember the movie where John Travolta and whatever the woman's name was, I can't remember her name, were practicing their dance routines in the dance studio. When they were shooting the movie, they were using the song Lowdown by Boz Scaggs from the Silk Degrees album. And they thought they'd use it in the movie. Well, Boz Scaggs would not let them use it in the movie. So they didn't reshoot it, but they changed the music for the movie. And they figured out later, this probably cost Boz Scaggs like $3 to $4 million because he wouldn't let him use this song in the movie.
His accountant never recovered.
Yeah, I'm not sure Boz Scaggs' bank account ever recovered.
That year as well, singer-songwriter Billy Joel released his fifth studio album, The Stranger, became the first of several hit albums, spawning five hit singles, going 10 times platinum in the U.S., and later coming in at number 70 on the Rolling Stones list of 500 greatest albums of all time. Now, you don't seem like a Billy Joel guy to me, Bill. Am I wrong?
No, you're wrong. I'm a big fan of Billy Joel's, and I think The Stranger is probably his best album ever.
Tell us more about music in 1977.
Well, one of my favorites, Steely Dan, the jazz rock group, released their sixth album, Asia, and it was a super great album, and it became their highest charting album of all time. Went to number three and went on to sell over 5 million copies. Some of the biggest hit singles that year were Hotel California by the Eagles, I Feel Love by the disco queen Donna Summer, Tonight's the Night by Rod Stewart, I'm Your Boogeyman by KC and the Sunshine Band, and one of my favorite artists, Jimmy Buffett, had his second hit with Margaritaville.
Outstanding. Some of the kids these days would be interested to know that the rock band Toto was founded that year. Toto, Africa. That song Africa is still popular amongst the kiddos these days. You'll find surprising, perhaps. The Supremes in 1977 performed their final concert as well. Final concert together at Drury Lane, London. Then they disbanded permanently. And then Elvis Presley, who we will talk about again in a moment, held his last concert at Market Square Arena in Indianapolis, Indiana. Bill, you want to talk about television here?
Sure. The TV show Soap debuted on ABC and launched the career of Billy Crystal. And if you've never seen the TV show Soap, it's a very, very funny television show. Also debuting that year was the show Eight is Enough, Three's Company, The Love Boat, and one that you and I both probably watch a lot of, This Week in Baseball.
Oh, absolutely. You know, my brother actually texted me a week or so ago and said, you've got to turn on Fox Sports 1. He said they're just playing over and over these This Week in Baseball shows. They were all from the early 80s. Yeah, Ron Guidry was in there, and then we saw one later where Dave Stewart made some intemperate comments that would not have gone over very well these days, but it was just fascinating to watch. Highlights from Mario Soto against the Braves. It was amazing to watch even this day. I wish there was something like that. You can't do it. The media environment is so much different now, but that was a big deal, This Week in Baseball was, back then when we didn't have so much baseball content everywhere you looked.
Yeah, you didn't miss it. I mean, you watched it every Saturday because it got you highlights from everybody.
Yep. And you got to see players that you never would see otherwise.
Right.
Good stuff.
Also, the premiering that year was the Richard Pryor Show. And you may not have heard of the Richard Pryor Show. And the reason for that was it only lasted 4 episodes before Pryor quit over censorship and interference by NBC. I know that comes as a big shock to everybody that they'd be trying to censor Richard Pryor.
Imagine that. Also, but comic genius Richard Pryor.
Yes. Also that year, The Amazing Spider-Man was on television. And if you've never seen this, it was so horrible and the special effects were so bad, it almost has to be seen to be believed.
Yeah, it's one that, and you can find clips of it, it's one that it looks like a parody that somebody just filmed, you know, out in the suburbs or something, you know. It was just awful.
Yeah, it's a neighborhood kid shot it in their backyard. I mean, when he shot his web, it was like a rope.
Right. It's just, if you've not seen it, you're missing out. Absolutely.
Yep.
Bill Murray joined the cast of Saturday Night Live that year. Who did he replace, Bill?
Chevy Chase. Chevy. Who, after 1 year, thought he was too big for Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I got to say that in the last couple of weeks, I watched a movie featuring both of these actors, Bill Murray and Chevy Chase. I'll give you one guess as to which movie that was.
Caddyshack.
Starring the immortal Rodney Dangerfield.
Rodney Dangerfield. And if you never got a chance to see Rodney Dangerfield in concert, you missed out. Watch him on YouTube. He is freaking hysterical.
Yeah, we talk about comedy geniuses, and he really is. He gets no respect, Bill.
None at all.
Sorry. That year, 11-year-old Janet Jackson joined the cast of Good Times, where her character was adopted by Willona. What left the air that year?
The classic Sanford and Son. Maybe the greatest sitcom of all time, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, The Electric Company, the children's show, and NBC's Emergency all left the air that year.
Sad times. In the world of sports, the Portland Trailblazers defeated the Philadelphia 76ers to win the NBA Finals 4-2. Bill Walton was selected as the MVP of the series. He was, of course, the star Hall of Fame center for the Blazers. The Sixers were led by Julius Erving. That's Dr. J, Bill.
I was a huge Dr. J fan. I'm not a huge NBA fan, and I was a bit bigger fan back then, and I was a big 76ers fan at the time because of the doctor. And the Sixers had great teams for about 10 years then, and I think they won one title in those 10 years.
Yeah, they didn't win one until 83, but they were right there every year.
Yep.
The Tampa Bay Buccaneers finally win a game after losing their first 26 in franchise history. Man, just historic.
Yeah, one of the best quotes I've ever heard was a reporter said that their head coach was John McKay, who had been at USC for a million years. And when the Bucs were created, he left USC to be their coach. And they asked McKay, could you tell us about the execution of your offense? He said, it sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, when can we schedule that? Super Bowl 11. The Oakland Raiders finally won their first Super Bowl by beating the Minnesota Vikings 32-14. Most valuable player, wide receiver Fred Biletnikoff.
Never dropped a pass, ever.
Never. It's documented. The Montreal Canadiens swept the Boston Bruins in 4 to win their second straight Stanley Cup. A.J. Foyt became the first driver to win the Indianapolis 500 4 times. And a couple of baseball notes, the Toronto Blue Jays and Seattle Mariners played their first game. And then in something that maybe foreshadows what we're going to talk about at the end of this podcast, Reggie Jackson blasted 3 home runs to lead the Yankees to victory over the Dodgers in Game 6 of the World Series. Who was, let's look, talk about who was born and who left us that year. Bill, I'll let you begin.
Kanye West, John Mayer, Michael Fassbender, Tom Hardy, Sarah Michelle Gellar, boxer Floyd Mayweather Jr., Randy Moss and Tom Brady from the NFL, and Roy Halladay were all born that year.
1977, also, we lost Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll, died at his home in Graceland at age 42. 75,000 fans lined the street of Memphis for his funeral on August the 18th. Do you remember that moment in history?
Yeah, I remember. I was in Jacksonville on the base at NAS Jacksonville when I heard that Elvis had passed.
Was it a gut punch to a lot of people at the time?
To a lot of people, I was never a huge Elvis guy myself. I'm a huge Beatles fan, and I think you tend to find people are either fans of the Beatles or fans of Elvis, and there aren't a whole lot of people that are both. I was a Beatles person, and I have some friends that are Elvis people, and they don't think much of the Beatles. So while it was, you knew it was a huge event in music history and in music, it didn't ring, it didn't depress me the way it did a lot of people.
Right. Three legendary American entertainers died that year. Comedian Groucho Marx died of pneumonia at the age of 86. Silent film actor Charlie Chaplin had a stroke at the age of 88. And Bing Crosby, The Voice, all passed away that year. Rough year for legendary entertainers.
Super rough year. Also, we lost that year. Freddie Prinze committed suicide at age 22, which is terrible. Legendary actor Joan Crawford passed away that year. And one that kind of this one did get me. Three members of the rock band Lynyrd Skynyrd die in a charter plane crash outside Gillsburg, Mississippi, 3 days after releasing their fifth studio album, Street Survivor. Perishing in the crash was lead singer and band frontman Ronnie Van Zant, singer Cassie Gaines, and guitarist Steve Gaines.
Yeah, just a horrible year. So let's move on to baseball, shall we?
Yeah, of course, for Reds fans, this isn't going to be a banner year for us either. So,
spoiler alert, 1976, the Reds finished, as you'll remember if you listened to the last episode, 102 wins, 60 losses, finished first in the National League Western Division, won the National League Championship Series in a sweep over the Philadelphia Phillies, and won the World Series, their second consecutive World Championship, in a sweep over the New York Yankees. So we move into 1977, and free agency smacks the Reds in the face immediately, didn't it, Bill?
Yeah, I mean, they had been pretty sure they were going to probably lose Don Gullett when he played out his option the year before. He'd always had injury problems. In 76, he had some shoulder issues that he had said were caused by him falling off a ladder repairing a barn down on his farm. But the Reds believed, and Rose and Morgan had said that he'd really hurt it in the Super Teams competition in Hawaii on the obstacle course. If you don't know what that was, back in the day, ABC used to have these competitions. One of them was called Superstars. It was individuals. And then later on, they did Super Teams. And what it was individuals from all kinds of different sports in the Superstars competition. And they would compete in different activities, different sporting events, and accumulate points. And, they would crown a champion. I remember Kyle Roat Jr., I think, won it a bunch of times early on. And then when that was very popular later on, they did the Super Teams, and they had the World Championship teams competing against each other. And that's where the Reds and Morgan and Rose had said where Gullett had really hurt his shoulder. And so on top of all the injury problems, Gullett was also upset that the Reds wouldn't offer him a long-term contract, which, because of the injury problems, probably as much to do with that as anything.
And so Don Gullett moves on to the Yankees, and then comes the shot heard around the world, essentially, in terms of the Big Red Machine. This whole podcast series we're going to be discussing, over the next few episodes anyway, when does the Big Red Machine end? And there are different markers. A lot of people would put the end of the Big Red Machine, though, on December 16th, 1976, I think, Bill. What happened that day?
Well, the Reds traded Tony Perez to the Expos and basically didn't get anything back for him. They felt that they had to get Dreesen into the starting lineup, and they either wanted a platoon at first base, which Perez flat turned down, or else they wanted a competition to see who was going to be the first baseman, which he also said no about. And the Reds probably knew he would say no to that. But as we've talked about before, Bob Housen was from the Branch Rickey School of Management, and he always believed that you were better off trading aging veterans and trading a year too soon rather than a year too late, especially if you had a reasonable replacement, which he felt he had in Dreesen. And the front office, I think they realized later that they undervalued Perez's effect in the clubhouse. And I want to read a little something from Big Red Dynasty. It says, for an organization that prided itself on thorough research, the failure to understand Perez's importance to the team was inexcusable. On a team full of big egos and awash in braggadocio, Perez policed the excesses. And I think that pretty well says it.
You know, I've long been a guy that kind of discounted clubhouse things and intangibles. But here's one instance where I think you can make a really good argument. And we'll talk more about this as we go on, because you can see some instances of this. Dreesen could hit, probably not good as good defensively as Perez. Those are things we can kind of measure in somewhat. But you cannot measure what Perez meant in that clubhouse. And there are real reasons to believe this isn't just, 20/20 hindsight. Frankly, it almost certainly had a real effect on what happened in that clubhouse and how the team played after this trade.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I'm like you. You and I are kind of the same thinking in this. I kind of poo-poo the clubhouse leadership and intangibles. I hate the intangibles argument, but it's really hard to argue on this one when, to a man, from management on down, they say that this changed the culture of the team.
And not that the team was immediately bad again, but we'll see. Certain things start creeping in that weren't happening before. So part of the reason as well, they had a replacement for Perez, but the Reds were also worried about their starting pitching now that Don Gullett was gone. And obviously Gary Nolan had constantly been injured. And Nolan was also unhappy with his contract situation. So part of the deal was they've traded Perez to get a pitcher, a couple pitchers that they hoped would help. Tell us about that trade.
Well, they traded Tony Perez and Will McEnany, who'd had the terrible, terrible season in 76, to the Expos for left-hander Woody Freiman and right-hander Dale Murray. Freiman was an old veteran. Murray was a young guy. They both would be gone by the middle of 1978, and Freiman would be gone a lot sooner than that.
And Sparky Anderson later said that not standing up for keeping Perez was one of his biggest mistakes as Reds manager. And Sparky was never shy about admitting when he made a mistake. And I think history has borne out that that was one of his bigger mistakes.
Yeah, if you read the Red Leg Dynasty book and you get to this section about where they traded Perez, it's very apparent the emotion from the other players, especially like Bench, when they traded Perez, that even whenever they wrote this and whenever they talked to him about it later, the emotion was still there. It was a very big deal when they traded Perez. And some of the players later kind of conjectured that they felt like that Housen had broken up the family. And if they, if Housen would do this to Perez, he probably would do it to me, being Bench or Morgan or Rose or whoever else. And it was a real loss of faith, I think, in management when this happened.
Yeah, and it makes all the sense in the world to keep the band together after they've won two in a row. Although most general manager types in all sports will tell you got to keep improving. You got to keep making changes. You can't just stand still. But wouldn't it have been fun to see what the 77 team would have done if they'd just, got the band back together for one more run? Alas, it didn't happen. Let's talk about something we discuss again every episode, and it's a lot different now. We talk about the salary discussions, the negotiations, the arguments, and with free agency now in the mix, it's kind of a different world, and there were more salary disputes than ever, I guess.
Well, yeah, and the average salary, it took a pretty dramatic jump. It went from $53,300 in 1976 to $74,000 in 77. And if you think of that, in terms of percentage, that's a pretty big jump.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge jump. And from the Reds' perspective, it seemed like everyone wanted a long-term deal and or were complaining about their salary, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. And they were like third in the big leagues in salary at the time for a team. But by March of 77, Morgan, Foster, and Griffey all had signed 3-year deals. Concepcion got a 5-year deal. Bench had already had signed a 2-year deal the year before, and he was in the second year of that. And you had to believe that these multi-year deals just killed Bob Housel, because as we found in prior seasons, he wouldn't even talk to people about a multi-year deal.
And Pete Rose, as usual. Drama, right?
Yeah, and you wonder, in retrospect, I mean, Pete liked the publicity. You know, and my guess is Pete didn't really think he needed a whole lot of spring training. And so, you know, he always liked being the last. I would think Pete liked being the last guy getting into camp. He ended up being the last holdout on this team. And he wanted a $400,000 per year deal, and he wanted a 1, 2, or 3-year deal. And the Reds didn't want to give it to him. And it became a public relations nightmare for the Reds, who eventually had to take out a full-page ad in the Inquirer trying to explain their negotiating position.
But Rose ultimately signed literally the night before opening day, got a $365,000 deal for 2 years, $365,000 per year. So we get to the season opening day, just a classic, beautiful, sunny opening day, right, Bill?
No. It was... The high temp that day was 41, and they had 4 inches of snow that morning. That's not my idea of a fun opening day.
It is not. Woody Freiman, newly acquired Woody Freiman, was the opening day starter for the Cincinnati Reds. He actually outdueled the previous year's Cy Young Award winner, Randy Jones, of the Padres. Raleigh Eastwick threw 3 innings of 1-hit shutout relief. Ken Griffey had 3 hits. And Bill Plummer started at catcher, and Plummer started the next day as well. Johnny Mish didn't play until the third game of the season, although Pete Rose did play after just signing the night before. Bill Plummer getting some prime time at-bats.
Yeah, my guess is that's Bill Plummer's only opening day start. And if you're not familiar with Randy Jones when he was pitching for the Padres, and he was a very, very effective pitcher with the Padres for a number of years, but he was not a hard thrower. Joe Morgan used to – I remember a quote from Joe Morgan saying that Randy Jones couldn't break glass, he threw so easy.
That's not very nice.
But they couldn't beat him. I've never looked up what his numbers were against the Reds, and I can't remember. But if my memory tells me that he's one of those guys, like Norman was when he was with the Padres, the Reds really, really struggled against him.
And he had a stretch there where he's a really good pitcher, and he's kind of been lost to history in terms of the general fan these days.
Yep.
But the season did not start out well. The Reds won only 5 of their first 15 games, and by April 25th, they were already back 7.5 games behind the Los Angeles Dodgers. And strangely, late in April, they actually won their last 5 games of April, 5-game winning streak, and they dropped a half game in the standings to L.A. So L.A. started well, the Reds started poorly, and so from the gate, the Reds were behind the 8-ball, weren't they?
Yeah, by the end of May, the Reds were 300.500, and they were 11.5 games behind the Dodgers. Dodgers had started 17-3. It's kind of hard to keep up with anybody that wins 17 of their first 20.
Yeah, that'll get it done, absolutely. So June 3rd, a highlight for the Reds, Freddie Norman threw a 2-hitter against the Astros, although he walked 8 and threw 153 pitches. As we've said many times during this series, it was a different time. Can you imagine somebody making it through 153 pitches to throw a complete game 2-hitter these days, Bill?
Most guys don't throw that in 2 games now.
It's true. Now, another recurring theme here, and this is really, it starts to become, this is as bad as it got. June 7th was the amateur draft, and tell us what happened in the Major League Baseball amateur draft, Bill.
Well, in the first round, the Reds drafted a third baseman, a kid named Ted Venger. And as per par for the course about then, he didn't make the big leagues. And he was the 8th first-round draft pick in a row that the Reds made that did not make it to the major leagues. So the scouting that we were bragging about all those years about the Reds had really dropped off. We weren't getting the information that we had gotten in the past. And this would really hurt the Reds' rebuilding efforts in the late 70s and the early 80s. The high point of this draft for the Reds was they got Joe Price in the 4th round and Tom Foley in the 7th round. Two guys that played in the big leagues and, you know, for the Reds for a number of years, but neither one of them were world beaters.
June 10th, for the first time, Tony Perez returned to Cincinnati. He went 3-for-10 with a double, triple, and 4 RBIs in that 3-game series, but the Reds won 2 out of 3. But it became pretty clear by mid-June that the Reds really had a problem in terms of pitching. And so, Bill, can you tell us how they analyzed that problem and what they did about it?
Yeah, as you said, their pitching was really struggling early. Three of their 76 starters were missing. Gullett was in New York pitching for the Yankees. Nolan was hurt again. And Santa Alcala, whose work ethic had always frustrated the Reds, and so they traded him early in the season. McEnany was gone. Manny Sarmiento had been sick, and they left him in Florida until mid-July. And the newcomers that they brought on board in 77, Dale Murray, Woody Freiman, Tom Hume, and Mike Caldwell, through the middle of June, were combining for a 5.52 ERA. So a couple weeks before the trade deadline, the Reds decided that there's no way they could catch the Dodgers with what they had in terms of pitching.
So Bob Housem started talking, as Bob Housem often did, and his discussions led to the New York Mets, where they were talking about one of the best pitchers in baseball, Tom Seaver, who reportedly wasn't getting along with the New York Mets owner. The Mets wanted Pat Zachary, who had been the Rookie of the Year, if you heard our last episode, in 1976. It was a really effective season for the Big Red Machine champions. And so the Mets and Reds were trying to put a deal together. At one point, it included Raleigh Eastwick, but he didn't want to go to New York, so that held up the deal. Shortly before the deadline, finally, it happened. The Reds sent Pat Zachary, Doug Flynn, and a couple of minor league outfielders, Steve Henderson and Dan Norman, to New York for Tom Seaver. Now, this is a pretty big deal, Bill. Am I right?
This is a huge deal, and it's a steal for the Reds. I mean, Pat Zachary had his best year of his career the year before with the Reds. Doug Flynn would always be nothing more than really a utility infielder. I think Steve Henderson got a fair amount of playing time in the big leagues, but was never anybody that, an all-star or anything. And I don't even remember whether Dan Norman ever made the big leagues. And you got, three really good years, 2.5 really good years out of Tom Seaver.
No question. Now, he was 32 at the time of the trade, so he was, older. But, for the next, for his time with Cincinnati, he was 75-46 with a 3.18 ERA. I mean, still a very, very effective pitcher. And
yeah, he was still Tom Seaver.
Yeah, he was still Tom Seaver. That's a good way to put it. I mean, he was really, really at the top of his game still. And so that immediately, you would think, would transform the rotation. And it did in some ways. Obviously, having him in the rotation helped. But that wasn't all they did, although they didn't do a whole lot that helped the Reds
Housem also, he got rid of Gary Nolan, who had said he was leaving after the season anyway, to the Angels. But since he was hurt, the Reds didn't really get anything for him. He moved Raleigh Eastwick to the Cardinals for a young guy named Doug Capella, who was okay. He recently acquired Mike Caldwell, and then he turned around and traded him to the Brewers for two guys that never made it to the big leagues, and this is one of his worst deals. Caldwell would go on and go 22-9 in 78 and come in second in the AL Cy Young voting, and he had a really good 79 for the Brewers too. So what the Reds have found at this point is all of a sudden their pitching staff was pretty old. Woody Freiman was 37. Freddie Norman was 35. Jack Billingham was 34. Seaver, as you said, was 32. In the bullpen, the guy they'll call up and we'll talk a little bit about in a little while, Joel Horner, was 40. Joe Henderson was 31. And Pedro Bourbon was 31. None of these guys were on the right side of 30. The guys that were unproven guys like Dale Murray and this Doug Capella and Paul Moskow, a rookie, were the only guys on the pitching staff that were getting any innings that were below 30.
And it's pretty stark in terms of the way that Bob Housem had always said, I'd rather trade a guy a year too early than a year too late, how all of a sudden he turns around with this team with a Steeler, one of the best offenses in baseball, and they find themselves with this over-the-hill pitching staff. It's like it had been neglected because they had such a good offense, frankly, is what it looked like. And maybe they were hoping that Tom Seaver would paper over some of those problems. On June 18th, Seaver made his debut for the Reds. 3-hit shutout, 1-6-0, beating ex-Red Santo Alcala. Seaver also went 2-for-4. George Foster hit his 18th home run. That pulled the record at that point for the Reds up to 34-27. They were within 6.5 games of the Dodgers, so they're feeling pretty good. You got Tom Seaver, and you pull as close to the Dodgers as you've been all season long, but that was the high water mark. They never got any closer, did they? Even though Seaver did his part.
Yeah, Seaver had a really, really good season after coming over for the Reds. Seaver went 14-3 with the Reds with a 2.35 ERA, but it wasn't all ice cream and roses on the pitching staff. And an example of that, I mentioned Joel Horner a couple minutes ago. On June 22nd, the Reds brought him up. He was 40 years old. So they bring him in to pitch. And with the bases loaded, in his first five pitches, he throws a wild pitch, then three wide of the plate for an intentional walk, and then gives up a grand slam on five pitches. That's not a good way to come to your new ball club.
Well, he did better, I'm sure, the next time he came out.
Well, yeah, 5 days later, against the Giants, he came again. They bring him in with the bases loaded, so he plunks the first two guys, and then he gives up a grand slam to Willie McCovey. Now, giving up a grand slam to Willie McCovey happened to pitchers a lot better than Joe Horner, but it's still two grand slams you've given up in two outings. That's not good.
What's Sparky doing, bringing him in with the bases loaded?
That must tell you what kind of shape the bullpen was in.
It was. And though, as we said, Tom Seaver helped out the pitching staff some, really it's mostly just bad news with one little bright spot other than Seaver the rest of the year. July 11th was not that bright spot. Woody Freiman, he was upset at Sparky Anderson for sending him to the bullpen, abruptly announces his retirement, headed out for his tobacco farm in Ewing, Kentucky. What's that all about, Bill? He just retired.
He just said, I quit. He does come back, but not for the Reds.
That's right. Now, this is Woody Freiman, obviously, that was obtained in the Tony Perez trade. And it's instructive maybe to look at what the Reds got out of that deal, because you'd think Woody Freiman really was a headliner of that deal, and now he's quitting. He's gone. So at the time, Tony Perez was hitting .269 with 10 homers and 48 RBIs for the Expos. Not Tony Perez's best season, but he was having an effective season for Montreal. Would you compare that at the same time to the Reds? The Reds were probably not upset with Dan Dreesen's output. I mean, he was hitting .303 with 12 homers and 57 RBI at that point. So his offensive numbers look better than Perez, but that does not tell the whole story, as we'll discuss later.
Well, and if you look at the seasons that Freiman, when he started 12 games for the Reds, went 5-5 and had a .538 ERA, and his ERA plus was 73. And the other guy they got for him, Dale Murray, went 7-2 in 61 games. But his ERA was .494, and his ERA plus was 80.
Not good. But July 21st, having that opening on the pitching staff, gave the Reds an opportunity to call up 21-year-old Mario Soto. Made his major league debut in July of 1977. Now, he would only be 2-6 with a 5.34 ERA the rest of that season, but Mario Soto would go on to have one of the best careers of any Cincinnati pitcher ever, and to me, one of the underrated pitchers in Reds history.
He's one of the guys that when people say you can't make it on two pitches, he's the guy whose name I always bring up.
Yeah.
Because he made it on two pitches.
Dazzling fastball and that incredible circle change. And if you can't hit either of those pitches, yeah, you can make it.
And who taught him the circle change?
Tell us.
Joe Nuxall.
The old left-hander. July 25th. Pretty big moment there for the Cincinnati Reds. Tell us about it, Bill.
Peter Edward Rose breaks the Major League all-time switch hit record with .2881, bypassing Frankie Frisch.
August 5th, Dave Parker, Cincinnati native, became the first player to reach the red seats in right field with a home run. Hit it off Fred Norman. Now, that's a pretty big blast out into those red seats anywhere you are. Dave Parker, of course, a left-handed hitter, but not the last time he would blast one at Riverfront Stadium.
Nope. Dave Parker was, when he was playing for the Pirates at this point in time, he was just probably the best player in baseball.
Yeah. Yeah. He was kind of a freak of nature in a lot of ways, could do everything.
Right. Yep.
August 21st, Tom Seaver heads back to Shea Stadium, threw a six hitter, struck out 11, doubled, and scored twice. So the Reds, you know, again, kind of hanging in there some. They actually played pretty good baseball, didn't they, in August, down the stretch, the dog days?
Yeah. They played .656 baseball in August. They went 21-11, but they could only go from 13 back to 8.5 back by the end of August, and they never got any closer than that.
Yeah, just could not. The Dodgers were just so good. The Reds could not make any ground up. September 13th, here's one of those moments we talked about that gives some indication into what it meant not having Tony Perez. And I'll let you tell us about it, but what happens essentially is the Reds get killed by the Astros, 13-4. And so the Reds are riding to the airport in the bus. Set the stage, tell us what happened there, Bill.
Well, they're going to the airport in the bus, and Anderson and the coaches are sitting up in the front of the bus because the coaches, and they always kept the coaches and the managers up in front of the bus. And they hear guys laughing in the back of the bus, and that's just was not done. You had to, whether you really believed that, you know, the world had come to an end after a loss or not, that's the way you held yourself. Well, Morgan walked back to the back of the bus to tell players that it wasn't all smiles up front, but the snickering just continued after he left. And the authors of Red Leg Dynasty felt that this change in attitude was in large part due to the absence of Tony Perez. They didn't feel like this kind of stuff would have happened when Perez was there.
And there's some indication that it might not have. So that's about where we are with this season. Tom Seaver does win his 200th game in September. And you think about bringing in Tom Seaver, Hall of Fame pitcher, to a team that has won two straight World Series championships. Again, that seems like a recipe for real success, but it couldn't. His heroics couldn't really help the Reds get any closer. He threw a two-hitter 5 days later. Rose extended his hitting streak to 20 games in a 4-0 win over San Diego, but the Dodgers clinched the division. So not a banner year for the Reds. One highlight, though, late in September, right?
Yeah, on September the 23rd, George Foster hit his 50th home run, which broke the team record of 49 that had been set by Ted Kluszewski in 1954.
And that's the season. The Reds finish up the season 88-74, 88 wins. Obviously not a bad season, but they do finish in second place, 10 games behind the Los Angeles Dodgers. The Dodgers, of course, would go on, as noted earlier, to lose to the Yankees in the World Series 4-2. And wrap up some of the season for us, Bill, if you would.
Well, Foster had an incredible season. He had 8.4 wins above replacement. He won the MVP. He led the league in runs, home runs, RBIs, slugging, and OPS, and total bases. As I said, he finished first in the MVP voting. The next Red was Pete Rose at 15th. And that's the first time all decade that they hadn't had multiple guys in the top 10, I would have to believe, without going back and looking. Johnny Bench recovered from his bad 76, and he had a 5 wins above replacement season, hitting 275, 378 with a 540 slugging and a 133 OPS plus, and he had 31 home runs that year. And the team did set a club record for fewest errors in a season with 95.
Joe Morgan had a good year, but not as good as the two previous years. He had almost 6 wins above replacement that season, a hit 288, 22 home runs, got on base at a 417 clip, which is pretty good. David Concepcion had a decent year. You said Johnny Bench. King Griffey had over 4 wins above replacement as well. So, the offense was pretty good, but the pitching was not. Tom Seaver and Fred Norman were the only Red starters above average. Now, Paul Moskow, he was close, and that would end up being his best major league season. He was about average. Pedro Borbón was still good. Manny Sarmiento was good when he was healthy, but the rest, just there's nothing really to talk about. And that's the story of the 1977 Cincinnati Reds. The other story for 1977 and beyond, obviously we've talked about it several times, and let's kind of look at Dan Dreesen versus Tony Perez, because the reason that Bob Hausman felt like he could trade Tony Perez was they had a guy waiting in the wings, and Dan Dreesen ended up having a pretty good career. But let's kind of look, if we could, Bill, at Dreesen versus Perez after the trade. What can you tell us?
Well, Perez was playing in Montreal, and they were playing in Olympic Stadium, and it was a slightly pitcher-friendly park if you look at Baseball Reference. And Perez's 3-year average, which was 77, 78, and 79, which is the period that we're talking about here, he averaged a 281, 338 on base, and a 447 slugging, an OPS plus of 115. And he averaged 33 doubles, 4 triples, and 15 home runs, and with a wins above replacement of 6.6. Do you want to talk about Dreesen?
Sure. Hitting in Cincinnati, which was a slightly hitter-friendly park at that time, his 3-year average in those same 3 years, 267 average, 350 on base, 427 slugging. So his OPS plus was 111 as compared to 115 for Tony Perez. 26 doubles, 3 triples, 17 homers. His wins above replacement, 5.1 during that time, which is, again, not bad. But his defensive wins above replacement, way down, negative 2.7, frankly. So what you see at, I think, Bill, it's fair to say that offensively they were about even, although I think you can maybe give a slight edge to Perez offensively, and you certainly give an edge to Perez defensively as well over that time.
If you're going by the defensive wins above replacement, you said that Dreesen was like minus 2.7. Again, these are Baseball Reference numbers. Perez was only minus 1.4. Now, he was no Keith Hernandez down there, but you know, he was probably almost, you know, almost twice as good as Reason was defensively. So if you look at the numbers, as you said, Perez was a little bit better and Dreesen was about twice as bad defensively. But the biggest loss, you know, by all accounts, were the intangibles that we talked about earlier. The things like leadership, his relationships with the Latin players, and the atmosphere that he fostered in the Reds clubhouse. And the stuff I've read, there isn't a whole lot of talk. There's some about the loss of this leadership in 77, but it's mentioned quite a bit in Red Leg Dynasty during the 78 season.
And we'll end up talking about that quite a bit as well next season. You know, the argument is that you have a guy who is ready to take over here. And I can kind of see what Housen was thinking. Now, I can't justify him not getting anything in return, essentially. But I can kind of see what he's thinking. But then again, Dan Dreesen was a pretty good player for the Reds. If you look at his stats, he really was a pretty good player for the Reds that a lot of people don't know outside of this.
He's a Reds Hall of Famer.
Yeah. Outside of this Tony Perez controversy, a lot of people don't know him, though. But I think you can make an argument that Tony Perez was better, slightly better offensively. He was better defensively. And, you know, if you add in the leadership, then the fact that they traded Tony Perez at all is a scandal. And the fact they traded him for a guy that retired 3 months into the season, really, it gets into that territory of being one of the worst deals in Reds history, I think. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I think you're making a good point. There's two different ways of looking at this. One is trading Perez at all and how much flack you want to take for that. And the other is the trade itself and what you got, which was nothing. So Housen was basically, you know, the one, you know, trading Perez, I think you can make the justification for, especially when they felt like they had somebody they could replace him with, and they undervalued the intangibles, whether that's you're right or wrong. But the trade itself, what they got for him, there's no defense of that.
Exactly. You can justify trading Perez for the same reasons that Bob Housen did justify it. And if they'd have gotten Tom Seaver in return, it would have been different, perhaps. But they didn't. You cannot. You can't defend what they did get back. The Reds' attendance dropped a little bit. Third in the National League, only 2.5 million. And
only 2.5 million.
I know. Exactly. You're right. Bill, there are some questions about this team. Can you tell us what are the primary questions as we get to the end of 77 and go into 78?
Well, I think as 77 ends, what you're having to think is this team aging and getting worse, or had the Dodgers just gone past them and gotten better? Was this a one-year issue, or was it a trend? And the other question you had to have was, can you really be disappointed in a team that won 88 games? I guess we'll have to wait and see in 1978.
Thank you for listening to Building the Machine, the brand new podcast series from Red Leg Nation Radio. To get each episode of the show delivered to you automatically, subscribe to Red Leg Nation Radio. You can find us at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play. Essentially, wherever you find podcasts, we're there. Many of the facts, figures, and anecdotes from today's episode came from baseballreference.com and the books Red Leg Journal by Greg Rhodes and John Snyder, Big Red Dynasty by Greg Rhodes and John Arardi, and The Big 50, The Men and Moments That Made the Cincinnati Reds by Chris Garber. Until next time, for Bill Lack, this is Chad Dotson saying so long, everyone.